The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's October. Check the calendar, folks. But is this a surprise? On Friday, FBI Director James Comey notified Congress about new emails that appear to be pertinent to the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. There was no assessment of their significance from Comey, but the odd public statement of the traditionally more circumspect FBI came as a bombshell. The emails were discovered through an investigation into former Congressman Anthony Weiner, Mr. Bombshell himself, the estranged husband of top Clinton aide Huma Abedin. Now the intentions of FBI Director Comey are fully in play. Is he covering his agency's reputation in the event of new congressional hearings if Hillary wins the election, or trying to dodge all-out punitive reactions from a newly empowered Trump in the White House? In any case, worst-case scenarios are stalking Washington and the candidates on the campaign trail this Halloween, and both Hillary Clinton and her opponent Donald Trump have called for the FBI to fully disclose everything possible before Election Day. Last night, the Justice Department had obtained a search warrant to begin searching a large cache of Huma Abedin's emails. With me now on the State of the Race is our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Quite a Monday, huh, Todd?
Well, and the immediate aftermath of an insane weekend of pre-election maneuvering. Bombshell is right, and you described it exactly accurately. And then a remarkable weekend of crisis political management, John, especially from Democrats, because what you've seen with everyone from Hillary Clinton herself and Tim Kaine on down through Democratic surrogates, Harry Reid and everyone else, is a concerted effort to make this entire conversation now about Comey and nothing else. His decision to go to Congress, what he disclosed, what they know and what they don't know, and not about Hillary Clinton at all. So you've seen statement after statement of from people like Tim Kaine going on the Sunday shows, like Harry Reid accusing Comey of breaking the law in a scathing letter that he wrote, basically saying this whole thing is about Comey. Listen to Tim Kaine here.
These could be duplicates of what's already been analyzed. They could be things that don't have anything to do with Hillary Clinton. We can't speculate about it. That's why we're asking the FBI director, okay, you violated these two protocols. If you've put out kind of a letter and then had to do a second letter to kind of backtrack, you owe the public full information.
He sounds totally polite. I mean, I've heard speculation that people think Comey's running for DOJ under the Trump administration or trying to get to the Supreme Court, and that he's got this whole thing figured out.
And none of that is knowable. That speculation is kind of fun and fevered and makes sense in this last week of the campaign. Here's something that we do know. James Comey, of course, himself, sensitive to the sensitivity of the timing of this announcement, and in a memo to FBI personnel, yet another leak coming out of the Justice Department and the FBI in the aftermath of this, Comey tells FBI personnel, look, I had to tell Congress because I had told him the investigation into the private server had come to a close. And if there's more information, I have a duty to tell them that. And I realize, he said, there is a significant risk of being misunderstood, his words, but I still had to do it. And I tried to strike a balance. The word from Democrats, of course, is you didn't strike any balance because you haven't even reviewed these emails. Nobody has. So such a brief statement to Congress was a field day for Hillary Clinton's political opponents and just fuel for endless innuendo. Nobody at the FBI has even read any of this stuff.
All right, yet. Come on, give us a sample of the level of, DEFCON 5 emotion in the candidates' voices.
In the candidates' voices? Boy,
yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
want to hear from Donald Trump?
Yeah,
here
let's
is.
Do it. Let's do it.
This magnitude's worse, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many people in law enforcement, this is worse than Watergate, what's going on with this. And what does she get out of it? She gets to run for the presidency of the United States. Explain that. Explain it.
Donald Trump told his crowds also that there are 650,000 emails that basically prove a criminal enterprise. None of that is true. Here's Hillary Clinton herself over the weekend.
You know, we've heard these rumors. We don't know what to believe. And I'm sure there will be even more rumors. That's why it is incumbent upon the FBI to tell us what they're talking about.
No, okay. VRC.
again from Hillary Clinton there.
Vast right-wing conspiracy.
That's right. Well, but what you do hear in Clinton's voice is where we started, which is this is about the FBI and this is about Comey. We can get a little data out of this, John. Everybody has to wonder about the polls. There is one post Comey leak, I'll call it, poll that's out, Politico Morning Consult just today, basically shows no change in the race so far. The race is tightening. All races tighten at the end. There is no way to know whether this is natural tightening or post-Comey tightening or other factors in the race. A lot of that's not really knowable. About a 3-point lead in this poll for Hillary Clinton nationally, which is essentially what it was before all of this news. And then we got to talk quickly about Donald Trump's really difficult path to victory here, no matter what the impact of the FBI investigation into Huma Abedin's computer. Because national polls are one thing, but Donald Trump's path to victory here is all but blocked when you look at the states that he would have to win. Here's the deal. In states that Hillary Clinton either has in the bag or leads heavily, she's already at about 270 or 274. And what that means in the last week of the race here, John, is that Donald Trump not only has to run the table on every single toss-up state, Ohio, Nevada, Florida, he has to run the table on those and then has to flip at least one state that's already strongly in Hillary's camp. You're talking like Michigan or Pennsylvania or New Hampshire, state that's already leaning heavily for her. So he's got to do all of that and flip a state. That explains why Donald Trump is campaigning in Michigan, where he really shouldn't be right now. He needs to flip like a Midwestern state. Meanwhile, tomorrow, Hillary Clinton is in Trump territory in Arizona, and that's the state of the race right now.
Great stuff, Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
You got it.
Open enrollment for health insurance coverage begins tomorrow, November 1st, the Day of the Dead, an auspicious coincidence given that the ACA finds itself right in the middle of the haunted house of the 2016 campaign. The Department of Health and Human Services confirms that benchmark premiums will be increasing by 25% over the next year, which makes for more monstrous charges in campaign commercials. But this open enrollment affects a growing population of people who've been through the chaos of Obamacare at least once and are both better educated and finding an easier-to-work-with system for the millions of Americans learning that they can shop around. Dr. Sarah Collins is Vice President of Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund. She says there are five things people should keep in mind as they go online to familiarize themselves with what's available.
First of all, ignore the headlines. We're hearing such scary news about premiums going up on average 25% across the country or even higher in some states. Most marketplace enrollees get a subsidy to help them pay for their coverage, and that subsidy will absorb most of those increases that we're seeing. So don't be afraid, particularly if you're uninsured right now. We know that about 3.5 million people are currently uninsured and are actually eligible for subsidies to help them pay for their health plans. We also know that a main reason why people don't go to the marketplaces who are uninsured is because they're concerned they won't be able to afford a plan. So it's really important, if you don't have health insurance coverage, to go to healthcare.gov. Between November 1st and December 15th, you'll be able to get coverage starting on January 1st, and just see what your options might be and what your prices might be. And I think that you'll be surprised how low your premiums might be.
That's number one.
Number two, about 2.5 million people who are buying coverage on their own are actually eligible for subsidies. So you might want to go to the marketplace, too, even if you have a plan that you've been buying directly from, and find out if you're eligible for a tax credit to help pay for your premiums.
So you could be eligible without knowing it.
You could be eligible without knowing it. So it's always a good idea to go directly to the marketplace if you're buying coverage on your own and just check out what your options are.
Don't be afraid of the headlines, and don't be afraid of actually going, because you might have a gift waiting for you there. Right?
That's,
so number
that's
three.
Exactly right. If you're currently enrolled in the marketplace and you went last year and you're paying the full premium, you might find out that you are eligible for a tax credit this year.
If you're already paying and you may not be eligible for the subsidy, you still might be eligible for the tax credit.
Right. So last year, your premium might have been too low for you to be eligible for a credit, because the way these work, you only pay a percentage of your income. So you pay maybe 4% of your income towards your premium. And the tax credit is based on the difference between what you pay and what the premium is. So if the premium goes up, you might actually get a tax credit this year.
So check.
Check, check, check. Very and really important, rather than just going directly to an insurance company, go to the marketplace. Shop around. that is really important for everybody. Let's say you're enrolled in a marketplace plan already this year and you want to go back and shop around. Your plan might not be the lowest cost plan anymore, so you want to shop around and see. And in fact, after shopping around, you might find that you'll even pay a lower price than you did last year.
So you can change plans?
You can certainly switch plans. Last year, 43% of returning customers change plans. So that's a remarkable number of people. Even if you're not eligible for a tax credit, it's important to go back and look and shop around. You might be willing to switch to a different plan if you can get a lower premium.
All right, so that's number four.
If you get stuck in the enrollment process, get help.
How would you get stuck? What would happen? Because that scares me now. The computer freezes, so what?
One thing that's really positive for the marketplace is there's a lot of choice of health plans. So about on average, even with the exit of a lot of insurance companies this year, on average, consumers will have 30 plans available to them across the country. So that's both a blessing and a curse. It's a lot of plans to choose from. They all have different combinations of premiums and deductibles. And so that can seem really overwhelming to people. So one way of trying to figure your way through this process is to use what's known as a cost calculator on the site. So you can get a sense of what a low premium and a high deductible might mean for you over the course of the year, or a higher premium and a lower deductible, what costs might be.
And if you feel really dizzy, who or what can actually help you?
So if you really need help, there are people and organizations called navigators, and they're in every single state. You can find a list of them on healthcare.gov, or if you have a state that runs their own marketplaces, like in New York, you'll find a list of people or organizations that can help you through this process. The other thing that HHS is doing too this year that's different, if you get hung up in the process, they're going to email you and help you and assist you that way, so electronically. So there, you'll find a lot more tools this year. If you've been signing up since 2014, the marketplace websites have matured over time, a lot more tools for consumers. But I think it is really hard for people, particularly if you're going for the first time, to really understand what a deductible is. And getting someone to help you go through this process is so important. And there really are a lot of people available to help you.
But do they charge you, like a tax preparer charges you?
They don't. These are free services. So avail yourself of the help that you need.
In your surveys, you must encounter some people who are really, really angry and who don't represent that, hey, I'm feeling better about everything.
Where people are really getting hurt in the Affordable Care Act are people who are above the threshold where they're eligible for tax credits. And they're going to see the biggest premium increases this year. They are really going to be pinched in their pocketbooks with the changes that we saw this year. It is very likely that the marketplaces are going to stabilize, particularly if policymakers focus on these fixes that need to be made to it. But one of them is increasing the subsidies. So maybe we need to go up higher on the subsidies to allow people to get the help with their costs. Someone with about $100,000 in income a year with a family of four isn't eligible for a subsidy. So I think if you're having to pay your full premium at that income level, it's going to feel like a big price tag. The other thing that people are very upset about, and this is across in the employer plans too, are the deductible sizes. So we've seen steady increases in the size of deductibles that people are subjected to. And we know the higher a deductible goes, the more likely people are to respond to that by not getting health care that they need or having really big bills that they have to pay if they go to the emergency room and have a $1,000 bill in 1 month. Most people don't have savings to cover that bill. So I think there needs to be a fundamental rethinking of the design of health benefits, both in the marketplaces, but also in the employer group market where most people get health insurance coverage.
Dr. Sarah Collins, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Sarah Collins is Vice President of Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The United States of political fracking isn't a drilling operation going on under the surface. It's right up top. The 2016 campaign has a different message for towns and villages, rural farms and big cities, depending on whether they find themselves in the electoral gusher of swing states, the gaseous pressure of possible purple states, or the silence of clear Republican or clear Democratic majorities. The American Communities Project wants to separate the signal from the noise in all of these smaller community groupings. The ACP has mapped every single county in America and assigned it a community type based on different demographics. In the final days before the election, we'll be talking to voters in each of 15 community types. You'll hear our first conversation in just a moment. But first, we spoke with old friend Dante Chinney, director of the American Communities Project and a political and data reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Well, the one thing we can say about this election in particular is there are a couple of these places that are really good for Trump right now. And one is working class country. Those communities are really made for Donald Trump. They're fairly socially conservative, but they don't have the religious overtones, really, of those evangelical hubs. They vote Republican. They're blue collar. They've really taken a beating economically in the past, like, 15, 20 years. So they're extremely Trumpy. I think the evangelical hubs, those places always vote Republican. They're having a tougher time with Trump. Trump, for them, really is a lesser of two evils for them because they are not Hillary Clinton fans. Graying America, those places, they're a bit like working class country. They're older, obviously, but they're also struggling economically. Native American lands are very interesting because they habitually vote Democratic. They're solidly Democratic. But obviously, they've got a bunch of very specific concerns to them, and they're cultural as well as economic. And there's no way those are going to be Trump communities in this election. But I wonder if they feel this election is really passing them by and not talking about anything that matters to them, which is definitely a possibility.
Well, they're very riled up about the North Dakota pipeline and have been on this program quite a lot. So suddenly there's an issue that really puts them at center stage.
And nobody's really taking it up, though, right? I mean, that's a problem for them. I think people in those communities probably feel as though they're being left behind to some extent, just left out of the conversation. I will say, though, they've got this issue that really matters to them in a campaign that just is not about issues.
I would say in the Hispanic centers, having heard not so much the issue, but the invective about immigrants be traded back and forth, that has to put them in a very odd mood this election season.
Yeah, and the thing that's particularly interesting to me about the Hispanic centers is the Hispanic vote. I mean, obviously, in some places, it's a question of whether people are eligible to vote. But still, turnout numbers have not been particularly high in those places. And I can't help but think, I don't know if they're particularly excited about either candidate in the positive way, but just with everything Trump has said, the thing that's going to be really interesting to me when the election's over is, do we see a real bump in turnout in those places? I think we very well may.
Is there an electoral piece to all of this? What are you seeing?
The divide in this election has become a chasm, right? It's a canyon. It's remarkable, the split we're seeing. And the thing that's really telling when I look at the data is big cities, which are heavily, heavily Democratic, you know, places they win by 30 points or more as a group, they're staying heavily Democratic. But what's happened is the suburbs, the big, dense suburbs around them, the place I call the urban suburbs, are also becoming incredibly Democratic, like swinging 10 points more toward the Democratic candidate. So at the electoral level, at the state level, what you're seeing is that's a real problem for Donald Trump in any place where you've got a big city, because it's not just the city anymore. But if it's a really big, complicated city with a big kind of environment around it, right, like kind of an urban environment around it, he's getting hammered in those places. So you look at what's happening in Pennsylvania is she's winning the big city of Philadelphia, as you would expect. But those four counties around Philadelphia, which are exurbs and urban suburbs, she is winning them by such margins now that it almost takes Pennsylvania off the table.
A complicated picture, but a fascinating one with all the data behind it. Dante Chinney is director of the American Communities Project, based at Michigan State University, a political data reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and a contributor to NBC News. Congratulations, Dante.
Thank you much.
We are going to focus on many of the issues that voters tell us are most important. Jobs.
Law and order.
Climate change.
Social security.
This next question comes from the public.
The biggest tax cuts.
Your schools are no good.
Immigration.
How can you unite a country?
Income inequality.
You have no job.
Gross national debt.
Pre-existing conditions.
Race.
You're living in poverty.
Uncertain issues.
Too much inequality.
Cyber attack.
Deportation.
The Supreme Court.
Discipline.
Let me repeat the question.
Woo! Okay.
So, let's begin.
It's a challenge every election cycle. How do you slice up the American electorate into groups that have meaning if you look at specific issues? Is there a way to really see how issues affect Americans in different communities? Answering this question is the mission of the American Communities Project that has divided the country into 15 distinct communities. Using these categories as a guide and a little of our own reporting, we've been pursuing an initiative we're calling Portrait of an American Voter. We're hearing your thoughts and concerns about the challenges facing our nation. It's not a scientific poll. It's more a personal, emotional exploration of how individual voters are making up their minds on issues from education and the environment to police brutality and PTSD. Up next, we hear from a voter in the LDS Enclaves community type.
My name is Lindsay Hanson Park, and I am 34. I have to think about that. And I work for a nonprofit that deals with Mormon scholarship and history. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah. I was born and raised here and have lived in different parts of the state for my entire life. Utah is known for Mormons, and I think it's known for Mormons for a good reason. There are a lot of Mormons here. It's the headquarters of the LDS Church. There's sort of this tension going on in Salt Lake City where we have a very conservative religious presence that has always been there, and then we have this counter-reaction to it. So there's this struggle between big government and small government, being suspicious of the government, not being suspicious of the government, and all of those residues come together in this sort of Mormon political landscape. Salt Lake City and parts of Utah have some of the worst air quality in the world. I would say that everybody here complains about it. They complain about just the air, and we call it the inversion because we have the mountains that sort of hold in the smog. So everybody knows about it. Everyone complains about it. And yet, when, you know, any sort of political action trying to be taken, there are a lot of grassroots organizations that have tried to enact change. Mormon politicians really fight back on that if they feel like, you know, any sort of big government, federal government regulations are going to come in. This is not openly spoken about. In Mormonism, we are a millenarian group. We believe someday in a second coming of Jesus Christ returning to the earth, and that we believe that the earth will be renewed to its paradisical glory and be restored. And so I think, as far as environmental issues, a lot of Mormons, although they might not admit this publicly, don't really think the world's going to be around that long to be destroyed. And I remember thinking that as a very faithful Mormon woman, that I was very concerned about the environment. I was very concerned about these things. And yet I knew that before it got too bad, before the earth got too bad, Jesus would come and it would be okay. And so I think that belief stops us from really worrying about sustainable action for the environment, because our faith tells us that God is going to take care of it. Now, of course, I don't believe that now. I believe that we have to be good stewards of the earth, and we can't just, you know, destroy everything and then expect it to be fixed.
To hear all 15 voices featured in our Portrait of an American Voter project, head over to thetakeaway.org/voter. In the world right now, there is a conflict seemingly immune to diplomacy. I'm not talking about Syria, where high-level government ministers are powerless in the face of an enemy they can't even speak to. Climate change.
Le désert.
The desert is advancing rapidly. The sand dunes shift, and they invade our agricultural lands. We lose about 104,000 hectares per year.
That's Adamu Chaifu, Niger's Minister of Environment. He seeks a compromise with a hostile environment that appears to want to swallow up his entire country.
This is an excerpt from the National Geographic series Years of Living Dangerously. The Niger predicament makes the job of correspondent Tom Friedman far more challenging than his reporting on the diplomatic nuances in a conflicted world as veteran columnist for the New York Times. Friedman's first book, you may recall, From Beirut to Jerusalem, brilliantly illustrated the contrasts in the Middle East. But as a correspondent for this National Geographic program, Friedman journeyed from the Paris summit on climate change to Africa's Sahel desert and saw the uncompromising reality. Tom, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, John. Thank you.
Can the folks in Paris have an impact? Can our conversation here have an impact on what's going on in the Sahel? Because that's really what it's going to take.
Yeah, there's no question. We can. It's not going to be immediate. The situation there is so much farther gone than people realize. For instance, John, you know, what was the Paris Agreement about? It was about preventing at maximum a 2-degree rise in global average temperature since the Industrial Revolution. Senegal's already there. They're actually heading for 4 degrees. Mm. That will make these countries unlivable. And the trickle of migration you see now, and that trickle is no small trickle. We're talking about 9,000 to 10,000 a month coming from around West Africa into Libya, trying to get into Europe. It will turn into a flood.
So let's listen to part of the interaction that you captured in this documentary. This is a scene from season 2, episode 1 of Years of Living Dangerously.
What these guys are doing is wrong.
I mean, these are people who have been laid off by the extreme actions of the commissioners that are inside this building. They've eliminated these jobs and the jobs of thousands of other people across the state.
Now, that's a highly produced moment of people yearning for freedom and demanding freedom. Can they demand that freedom in this environment where environmental factors are out of control of traditional political institutions?
Well, you frame the question, I think, exactly right, John. Man forgives. Mother Nature doesn't forgive. She has no heart, no soul, and the forces that we as human beings have unleashed will require extraordinary human action and collaboration to tame. Now, you can say, well, what is this? You know, maybe it's for the far-off distant future. Yeah, let me just remind our listeners of something. You know, Barack Obama, when he took over second term, agreed with Republicans on a $600 billion tax hike, $60 billion over 10 years. The same week, that was the first week of Obama's second term, the House and Senate passed the cleanup Superstorm Sandy. One storm, $60 billion. In other words, one storm ate the entire tax increment for that year.
Hmm.
Pleasure,
you know,
John.
People have admired your career and the way in which you shifted from a traditional journalist to really someone who tries to see deep within problems, deep within transformative dynamics in the earth, and not reduce them, but produce handy little islands for us to grasp onto. The world is flat is an example of that. And, you know, put the Friedman engine to work on this problem here. How are people in different parts of the world going to have handy anchors and hooks to grab onto to collectively deal with this kind of thing? I mean, that's the challenge that you've really embarked on here in this documentary.
You know, no question, John. People ask me why I went into journalism, and we all go into this business, you and I alike, for different reasons. And I went into it because I love being a translator from English to English. I like taking complex problems and trying to break them down so I can understand them and therefore others can understand them as well. And I think that, you know, the biggest image I could use as a takeaway from the documentary I did on human migration from Africa is that we're really seeing a new divide in the world emerge. It's the world, the main geopolitical divide is no longer east-west, north-south, communist-capitalist. Really, the main geopolitical divide now is going to be between the world of order and the world of disorder. And you're already seeing that take shape with the Mediterranean, now one of the main dividing lines. Because we've seen these refugees flowing out. Most people think they're from Syria and Iraq, and some are. But, John, close to 80% are actually from Africa. And they are, you go into these villages, as we show in the documentary, and they're basically no men between the ages 18 and 60. They have all left because climate change has reduced the ability of the land to produce food and jobs to sustain these men, and at the same time, their populations have exploded.
See, this is what's so exciting about talking to you here, because what you've just described there is one of those anchors. When we talk about immigration, we need to think of it as an environmental issue, not as some political issue. That's really the way in which we're going to reformulate. I mean, it's a Noah's Ark kind of thing that's happening.
There's just no question about it. And one of the problems you have, you know, if a Syrian is abused by their government and knocks on our door, we actually that person has certain legal international rights as a political refugee. If an African who is abused by nature knocks on our door, by way, natural forces, which in many ways we contributed to, he or she has no rights because there's actually no international convention for migrant refugees, and yet they're going to be the biggest group cohort in the world.
You know, we could talk about this for hours, but we have to go. Does TV pack enough punch here to make the points that you want to make?
John, this is my second season with Years of Living Dangerously. I'm just incredibly proud to have been part of this project. It is among the most compelling journalism adventures I have been able to participate in my 40 years in the business. It's incredibly exciting. It's great TV, and it tells a hugely important story.
Tom Friedman is columnist for the New York Times, a correspondent for the National Geographic program Years of Living Dangerously. First episode of Season 2 aired last night. His upcoming book is called Thank You for Being Late. Thanks so much, Tom.
Pleasure, John.
Thomas Friedman is a columnist for the New York Times and a correspondent for the National Geographic show Years of Living Dangerously. The first episode of Season 2 aired last night, and Friedman's upcoming book is called Thank You for Being Late.
Even though my position may be one of ignorance and stupidity, I don't know that until I can learn it. You know, and I need friends to let me see it.
That's the award-winning, sensitive, vulnerable actor Ethan Hawke, who put his sensitivity to work as part of our mission to have some open and frank conversations about race in America. Conversations you can hear and that we believe mirror what we think is going on at kitchen tables and public places all over the country. It's all part of the racial transformation taking place in America right now. Last week, we introduced you to Rebecca Carroll, editor for Special Projects at WNYC, who's hosting the first set of conversations in this series. In her first interview with Ethan Hawke, Rebecca and Ethan spoke before a live audience.
Never in my conscious adult life has race been more a part of the conversation than it has been in the last 5 years. Do you know? And I often find myself thinking about, why is that? I mean, let me say, for example, like, I was at the Oscars sitting next to Denzel Washington when he won the Oscar, right? And Halle Berry also won that year. And there was a great feeling. Sidney Poitier was being honored there that night. And Denzel got up and said, you know, I'm following you my whole life. And it was very kind of beautiful. And it really felt like, to me, in the room, that isn't it great that all that stuff is behind us? It had this feeling.
Wow.
To, you know, and maybe I'm like, you know, crazy, you know, optimist kind of person, but I was like, oh, I'm so glad to be alive in the era where we're like putting this behind us, you know? And then to have last year, the whole thing about the Oscars being so white and really people coming to task with it. And what I'm trying to say is there is no way to avoid talking about it with your kids because it's very, very much a part of what is happening. There's something happening. I'm sure that every parent is talking about it in some way.
Really? You're sure? I don't know. I don't know if that's true. So
kids
so,
ask a lot of questions.
No, they do ask a lot of questions. But I think, you know, the idea or the term of implicit bias, you know, when your kids, your older kids see that, do they have black friends? Do they have friends who might get pulled over? Do they have friends who might get shot?
It's getting so, to my eye, it's at least in Brooklyn, at least in New York, I don't know what it's like to grow up elsewhere. It's getting so, people are looking so deeply into the fabric of the language of racism. They're looking beyond the surface, knee-jerk, saying the right thing. Like, for example, last year, my daughter's senior year, she was out there protesting in Brooklyn against the cops and doing all sorts of stuff. But at the same time, there was a real outcry in her school that they weren't racially diverse enough, that she goes to a private school, and some of the African-American kids in the school were really saying, you know, what are you out here protesting for? It's, you know, we have a real problem with, you know, our school.
Right.
And I don't know. It's very complex. I have the good fortune of having a mysterious, I get placed in a weird position. For example, when I did Training Day in Brooklyn's Finest, two times in my life, thank you, I got to do a lot of ride-arounds with police officers, where I would just sit in the back of a car, and this is, you know, in the height of stop and frisk, right? And I could sit in the back seat and going, how come you guys, you never stop any white people? You know, like, why is that? Like, well, they're not scary. I said.
Did they actually say that?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was privy to getting to act with Denzel Washington, one of the greatest actors in the history of acting, as far as my awareness goes. And I'm sitting next to him in this Monte Carlo in South Central LA, and the NAACP wants to talk to him about why he's playing a bad guy. And he's, I get to be a fly on the wall to him saying, hey, what? Nobody comes up to Gene Hackman and gives him a hard time for playing a bad guy. Nobody comes up to Al Pacino and gives him a hard time.
So when these things are in the news, these shootings, this viral video footage of police killing black bodies, how do you have that conversation with your children, with your peers? Do you or do you not have it, like on a daily basis?
Well, my mother's in town, and we were talking about race with my 18-year-old last night because, for very complicated reasons, actually, because things that, to respect my daughter's privacy, I don't want to talk about, but having to do with just being a woman and the difference of growing up a white woman versus growing up a black woman, and they're sharing dressing rooms and they're intimate at school, and there's just experiences are different. And so it's, the shootings are so dramatic. I mean, see, the thing about the shootings to my mind, and I don't know if I'm, you know, what I can say and I'll get in trouble for whatever. I think the difference there, what's happening there is telephones or iPhones and technology. Things like that have been going on forever, right? But now we can look at it, and then the white community goes, oh my God, that's terrible. And the black community gets to say, and then we have this like thing that's hurting that we can see. So in a way, how do I talk about that violence with my kids? It's very difficult to talk about. I find it funny because kids are so pure. I really find that kids get taught a lot of things, and how you use language is so important. And by even trying to explain to them why you shouldn't be racist starts an idea in their head that they didn't have before. Like, well, these bad cops did, you know.
Right. But shouldn't they have that in their mind? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, of my own kid, like, you know, it's not an option. Like, I have to talk to him about race and racism and what's going on with the police and the violence and how he should behave and so on and so forth. And so on.
But don't you think more than anything about what you say is your life is your message, right? How you comport yourself, who your friends are, how you behave, who you listen to, who you read, who you take seriously. If they see you, you know, if my kids see me reading Toni Morrison, do you know? That has an impact on them, you know? And yes, I can say things, but I have to tell you that I don't feel an expert on how to teach children.
Oh,
you know?
None
and
of
so
us
I'm
are.
So I'm nervous about it. I can share with them my experience. Like you talk about, I mean, my mother, we have a very funny story in our family, which is that my mother was a youth group leader, right? And one day in this youth group class, this kid from Addis Ababa, you know, for Ethiopia, very dark-skinned, very African-looking, beautiful, you know, very Ethiopian-looking, you know, the crazy intelligent, kind of princely look that he has. And he has nowhere to live. He shows up at he's apparently had a foster home and they split up. It took him a long time to get over here and they split up in the intervening time period from when they signed up. And then he showed up at this youth group, and so he came home to spend the night with us that night. And he stayed for, what, 5, 6 years? What, 6 years? 5 years before he graduated. He was in eighth grade, so he graduated.
And he lived with you?
Yeah, yeah. And that was a real learning lesson for me, because in my neighborhood, I'd walked home from school every day since I moved there. And I, you know, we'd lived there 5, 6 years already when he moved in. And he got stopped by the cops coming home. And I remember, I just couldn't believe it. Mm. You know, things I'd heard, you know, racism had just been this kind of fictitious. I mean, I knew about it. I studied Martin Luther King. My grandfather fought the Klan. But I didn't experience it.
And you never will. But.
I never will. No, good point. But that's, I mean, that's how Out to Lunch. But you can grow up that far. Most people's mom don't bring a kid from Addis Ababa into their house, right? And so that was the closest I can come, right? Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen once. You know, it happened at least 3 times. And he had, he couldn't, he's the most gentle person. I mean, you could possibly imagine, the least threatening person you could possibly imagine. He's so beautiful and kind. And that was a learning lesson for me. And you're right. I mean, how, that's what you even joked about when you first invited me on the show. I'm in no position to talk about this, except to say, every time we use, the reason why I was so disappointed in Hillary for doing that basket of deplorables comment is that every time we act like somebody else isn't a human being, you know, mm-hmm. That everybody isn't coming at their life from their point of view with their love, the things that they love, you build up the wall and the wall gets harder and more cemented. And every time we can talk and anytime you can make fun of me and we can laugh and every time that happens, the wall comes down a little bit. But if we don't talk about it, then we neither one of us hear anything. And I'm not
exactly.
And you don't, even though my position may be one of ignorance and stupidity, I don't know that until I can learn it, you know, and I need friends to let me see it, you know, and that's the value of you inviting me onto here and having a conversation, right? Because I'm not alone.
Actor Ethan Hawke speaking with Rebecca Carroll in the WNYC Green Space. If you want to attend Rebecca's talk with actress Kristen Davis, you may know her as Charlotte in Sex and the City, go to WNYC.org/thegreenspace. That's G-R-E-E-N-E. The November 18th conversation will be about interracial adoption. But as with all these discussions, Rebecca reminds us, in the labyrinth of America's racial truths, they may start somewhere, but where they end up is anyone's guess. We love your comments. Find us on Facebook at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.